You have your Bible this morning. We are in the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 this morning. Ecclesiastes chapter 5. And we're going to begin reading at verse 8. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, beginning our reading in verse 8 of this chapter, where Solomon writes, "If thou seest the oppression of the poor, and violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter. For he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. Moreover, the profit of the earth is for all, the king himself is served by the field. He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This is also vanity. When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. There is a sore evil which I have seen under the sun, namely, riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt. But those riches perish by evil travail. And he begetteth a son, and there is nothing in his hand. As he came forth of his mother's womb naked, shall he return to go as he came. And he shall take nothing of his labor which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a sore evil, that in all points as he came, so shall he go. And what profit hath he that hath labored for the wind? All his days also he eateth in darkness, and he hath much sorrow and wrath with his sickness. Behold that which I have seen. It is good and comely for one to eat and to drink, and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him, for it is his portion. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth, and hath given him power to eat thereof, and to take his portion, and to rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God, for he shall not much remember the days of his life, because God answereth him in the joy of his heart." And we trust the Lord to add his blessing to the reading of his precious word. Well, at the outset of this chapter, we saw last Sunday morning the right way to worship. But now Solomon is turning his attention to rather more mundane, earthly things. In particular, he wants us to focus on the matter of money. Now, we all need money to get by, but what Solomon is addressing here is what I describe as our money problems. I wonder, do you have money problems? You know, some people do, and it's amazing what they will do to resolve them. Just yesterday, I read of a young Slovenian woman, who sawed her left hand off in order to claim £700,000 worth of insurance against five insurance companies. She signed up for this personal injury insurance with five companies last month, and she and her boyfriend together conspired to rob these companies of £700,000 of compensation by her sawing her hand off. You know, I wonder how much does your heart or my heart yearn for wealth? Some years ago, there was a survey conducted that asked this question: what are you willing to do for $10 million? 25% of those surveyed said they would abandon their entire family. Some people would abandon their family for less than that. 23% would become prostitutes for a week or more. 16% would leave their spouses. 10% would withhold testimony so as to let a murderer go free. 7% agreed that for $10 million they would kill a stranger. And 3% would put their children up for adoption. What would you be willing to do for a huge sum like that? You know, Paul, writing in 1 Timothy chapter 6, says that they that will be rich fall into a temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition, For the love of money, he says, is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Well, here in this chapter, Solomon says much the same thing, but he goes a little more into detail. Let's look at verses 8 and 9 to begin with. He says in verses 8 and 9, "If thou seest the oppression of the poor, and violent perverting of judgment, and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter. For he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they." Excuse me. "Moreover, the profit of the earth is for all. The king himself is served by the field." So he begins by highlighting the problem of corruption and oppression in government. It was Lord Acton who said in the 19th century that power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And sadly, human experience bears that out, does it not? You know, if we look in our own government, or indeed the governments around the world, whether they're communistic or capitalistic, it really makes no difference. You know, communism paints this ideal picture of a perfect political system. If you listen to the communist, he tells you that under that system, all men will be treated equally and fairly, and that everyone would labor for the common good of the whole. But we know that in every communist regime, the world throughout and history throughout, there's always those who are more equal than others, and there are always those who do better than everyone else. On the other end of the political spectrum, we have capitalism, which often makes men fabulously rich, but does so on many occasions at the expense of the poor. You know, many of us in the West are wearing clothes which have cost us quite a small fortune on some occasions to purchase, but which actually was produced by people who were paid in pennies. Money matters to God. He's interested in our relationship with it. Jesus said, "No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other." You cannot serve God and mammon, mammon being money. So we have to have a healthy outlook on our income, otherwise we're going to end up at odds with God. Now, before we begin into this passage, or as we get into this passage, we find before us seven problems with money that will enter into your life if you make money your goal, if you make the pursuit of money your sole purpose in life without a place for the Lord. And here's what I want you to see in verse 10. Here's problem number one. The more you have, the more you will want. Look what it says here in verse 10. "He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This is also vanity." Notice that this proverb, much like Paul's words in 1 Timothy, concerns itself with the love of money. He that loveth silver, not he that had silver. Of course, we have to have silver, don't we? We have to have money in our pockets in order to buy groceries and buy the things that we need. But Solomon is speaking here about the love of money. And he's saying, and no matter if you give yourself to the love of money, you'll find that it's never enough, that you'll never have enough of it. You know, again, I read in the newspaper this week past that the Rolling Stones rock band has opened a shop in Carnaby Street in London's West End. They're selling there everything from T-shirts to hoodies to denim jackets to key rings to guitar plectrums to water bottles. This is not an advert, but all of it comes with a Rolling Stones brand. Now, here's what I thought to myself when I read that news. Why does Mick Jagger and company really need that extra income? You know, these guys are in their 70s now. They're late 70s. The oldest band member is nearly 80 years of age. Charlie Watts, the drummer, is nearly 80 years of age. And here they are launching out in this shop at the heart of London, in London's West End, in order to gain more money. How much are they worth? Well, between the four of them, they're worth a net value of $900 million. Almost $1 billion between four of them. You think if you had $1 billion at the age of 80, you'd say, maybe I should retire. But far from retiring, They're launching into a new business venture. You know, many years ago, Keith Richards and Mick Jagger wrote the song Satisfaction with its well-known chorus repeated over and over again. I can't get no satisfaction. And so it would seem. Yet the Rolling Stones are not alone in this respect because others were just like them. The famous businessman J.D. Rockefeller was once asked how much money is enough, to which he replied, just a little more. You see, friends, we think that money will satisfy us. But it never does. It will simply create the urge to gain even more. Here's a second problem with money. The more you have, the more others will seek after it. Look in verse 11. It says, when goods increase, they are increased that eat them. Now, Solomon, of course, is a king. And he was a very wealthy king at that. He was one who taxed his people very heavily. We know that because when his son Rehoboam came along, he was advised to ease the tax burden upon the people in order to win their favor. So we know that people were taxed fairly heavily under Solomon, and it may be that he was thinking of taxation because the more money you make, the more the government takes. Isn't that the way it works? The more you make, the more they take. Now, most of us pay a tax rate of 20% on our, you know, taking our allowances into account, we pay 20%. So that's £1 in every five that we make, we're making for the government. You think about that. People in our society as a whole work one day a week just for the government. You ever think about that? Isn't that a very discouraging thought? I mean, if you thought about it that way, would you want to get up for work? If the government allocated the first day of the week and said, Monday's our day that you work for us, you would have no impetus to get up. You say, I don't want to go and work for them. You know, I thought this was kind of funny when I thought about it because, you know, people are very excited about this £10 that the government gave us to go and eat out last month. You know, they said you can go and eat out and we'll pay up the half your bill up to £10 per person. And yet £10 per person is nothing compared to one day's work that everybody was working in the week to pay the government. And guess what? The wealthier you get, the more they take. Once you're over £50,000, they take 40% of your income. That means you're working 2 days out of five in order to service the government. You know, it was Benjamin Franklin who said there are only two things certain in life, death and taxes. Well, some people say, well, you know, that may be true, but if I could just win the lottery, you know, if I had a pound for every time I've heard somebody say, wouldn't it be great if I could win the lottery? Even people, mostly people who don't do the lottery, actually. Mostly Christian people who don't even do the lottery say, wouldn't it be great to win the lottery? Wouldn't it be amazing to win the lottery? What would you do with all that money if you just could win the lottery? And of course, one of the advantages of winning the lottery, if there are advantages as such, is that you don't get taxed. You can win millions of pounds and the government doesn't consider it as income and they will let you enjoy it, apparently tax-free, until you're dead. And when you die, guess what? The government wants its money back. And it comes and it charges 40% inheritance tax on that kind of income, on that kind of money. So, you know, if you die, your children are going to be left with this multi-million pound tax claimed by the government. And it's not just the government that comes after our money. You know, when you think about it, it's others. When Elvis Presley was alive, of course, he became very rich with his music. And there was, I understand, people on his payroll who were earning a very nice sum, thank you very much, that he didn't even know. He didn't even know them. And they were taking from him. They were sucking off him. And you see this with famous people all the time. You know, the moment people get famous and rich, well, what do they need? They need bodyguards. What do they need? They need minders. They need PR people. They need secretaries. They need all kinds of people. And so you see them in these in airports and elsewhere in your papers. You'll see them surrounded by such people, by floozies and hangers-on and bodyguards, people who are always ready to milk you of anything that you have. But if they don't get it, you know, if the government doesn't get it, and the hangers-on don't get it, guess what? Others will get it. You see, the more money you have, the more expensive your tastes. You see, that's the way it works. The more junk that people will sell you. Again, you know, just reading the papers, this stuff is as up-to-date as today. You know, I read this week of a super yacht that is being proposed that is to be built in the shape of a swan. So you can sail the waters of the world in this luxury yacht that looks like a swan on the sea from a distance. Now, I have to admit, it was a beautiful design. There's no question about it. And if you wanted one of those yachts, it would cost you $500 million, half a billion pounds. Now, my question to myself was this: does this swan get you to your destination any quicker? No, it doesn't. And so you have to ask, well, who's going to spend that kind of money on something like that? You know, I wouldn't do it, and you wouldn't do it, but perhaps if you had that kind of money to throw around, here's the long and short of it, there's always somebody there who's ready to take it from you. And of course, if you're that super rich that you can afford such a plaything, then you would happily want to show it off, wouldn't you? You'd say, well, I could do it. Why? Because I can afford it. And that's what Solomon says. He says, here's the problem. The more you have, the more others will seek to take it from you. And here's the third problem in verse 11. He says, the more you have, the greater the sense of nothingness. The more you have, the greater the sense of nothingness. Look at verse 11 at the tail end there. It says, what good is there to the owners thereof of all their wealth and possessions, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? You think about it, you know, when you buy something, the first day or two you're enamored with it, you know, you like it, but after that, what? It's just something you look at. It's just something you look at. Now, we were on holiday in France last year, and I saw an egg timer, a lovely little egg timer, which kind of, I don't know why I got attracted to it. I liked it at the time. It was on a sale. I think I paid £8 for it. Everybody was looking at me like, why are you buying an egg timer? But I just liked it, and so I bought it, and now it sits in our living room. And, you know, I look at it. Every day I look at it, I think, why did I buy that? You know, it's not a particularly spectacular egg timer. My grandchildren enjoy playing with it. It's not, you know, I don't even know what time it keeps. But I look at it. That's all I do. I behold it. Now, that's no big loss to me, but that's how we are with so much of what we buy. And remember in chapter 2 of this book, when Solomon was speaking, he talked about how he acquired houses and vineyards and planted gardens and orchards and made lakes with dancing fountains. Do you remember all of that? And he hired a household full of servants, and he had more than any man could have before him. He had choirs, and he had musicians playing on music night and day. And why? What was the purpose? To satisfy the lust of his eyes, simply so that he could look out and say, that's my orchard, and that's my vineyard, that's my choir, and that's my dancing fountain. These things are mine. I can have them because I can afford them. Was he happy with it all? Well, if you remember back in chapter 2 in verse 11, he says, I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought. I beheld them with my eyes, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit. I was chasing the wind, he said, and there was no profit under the sun. Do people feel like that today? Many of you remember the legendary tennis player Boris Becker. Boris Becker was at the very top of the world of sport, and in particular the world of tennis, and yet he was at that time on the brink of suicide. He said, I had won Wimbledon twice before, once as the youngest player. I was rich. I had all the material possessions I needed. It's the old song of movie stars and pop stars who commit suicide. They have everything, and yet they are so unhappy. I had no inner peace. I was a puppet on a string. Jack Higgins, the famous novelist who wrote The Eagle Has Landed, was asked what he would like to have known as a boy. You know what he said? That when you get to the top, there's nothing there. That when you get to the top, there's nothing there. You see, gold cannot fill the human soul. Gold is no substitute for God. And no matter how much gold or wealth or possessions you possess, they cannot fill the God-shaped void of the heart, because God is eternal and there is nothing you can put in that hole that will complete it. The only thing that will satisfy that need that comes within the inner heart of man is the Lord Himself. Here's the fourth problem with money. The more you have, the less you sleep. The more you have, the less you sleep. Look at verse 12. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. Now, when you think about this, Solomon is making a comparison here between a laborer and between a wealthy person. And as I thought about this, I thought, well, who would be a good example of someone who's a laborer who could sleep well? And I thought perhaps of a plasterer, you know, someone who plasters your walls. And how he would get up each day. You know, I watched a man plastering a wall in my house, and I thought, man, that's hard work. That is hard work, especially when you get to the ceiling. That's really, really heavy going, and it's physical, demanding work. And so you think about a plasterer. He gets up each morning. He shows up at the building site. He begins his day's work. It is heavy. It is laborious. And by the end of the day, he's worn out. And then what? Well, he packs up his tools. He goes home. He has a shower. He maybe has his tea. And then maybe he takes his children out to a swimming lesson. Or if he's a Christian man, maybe he comes out to Bible study. Or maybe he's got to go to a parent-teacher evening. And then he returns home, and maybe he plops himself in front of the telly for a little while. He grabs himself at the end a cup of tea and a little bit of toast, and he's off the bed and he's out like a light. Now think about the managing director of his building company. He's dealing with all kinds of matters that the plasterer doesn't have to worry about. He's dealing with the finances of the company. He's dealing with the government regulations placed upon the company. He's dealing with competition. He's dealing with personnel, with resources, with requisitioning. He's dealing with all kinds of matters that the plasterer doesn't even have to think about. He comes in late, perhaps from a late evening's black tie charity event. His belly is full of rich food. His hand reaches for the Gaviscon. And in short, he has more worries. The night is sleepless. His head is chock-a-block with thoughts. Look at chapter 5 and verse 3 and says, "For a dream cometh high through the multitude of business." So he comes home and there's all kinds of thoughts going through his head. What he's got to do in the morning, who he's got to see, what he's got to look at, what he's got to attend to. And it's all going through his head. And so he tosses and turns all night dealing with the demons of his mind. And then he wakes up the next day, and maybe you've woken up at this time, sometimes like this, feeling like you'd never been to bed in the first place. You ever woke up like that? More tired than when you started. Now let me ask you, between those two, who's really having the best time? You see, you can't tell me that Solomon didn't know what he was talking about. Because Solomon was among the super rich of his day. If he were alive today, he'd be the guy with the swan-shaped yacht. He knew what it was to go to bed at night and worry about his riches, worry about his wealth. You know, I remember hearing one time about a burglar who broke into a house in Dublin and he stole a poor man's golf clubs. And then he took pity on him and he left him a pitcher and putter and took the rest of the golf clubs. But you know, I've often joked that sometimes if people break into my house, they'd probably leave me something rather than taking something. But you know, here's the thing, folks. You know, the more you have, the less you're going to sleep. The more you have, the more there is to worry about. And you can't tell me that this book of Ecclesiastes is not a practical book. It's helping us to get things in perspective here. It's not saying that earning money is a bad thing. It's not even saying that doing well in life is a bad thing. It's saying that making that your goal in life, being a greedy individual whose entire purpose is eaten up with possessions and money and wealth without thought of God, is a bad thing in life. Notice verse 13. Here's the fifth problem. The more you have, the more destructive its potential. The more you have, the more destructive its potential. Look at verse 13. Solomon says, "There is a sore evil which I have seen under the sun, namely riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt." He describes this as a sore evil. The phrase literally means it's something that makes him sick to the pit of his stomach. When he thinks about this, it really moves upon him emotionally. And what is it that he's concerned? What is it that eats him up? Well, he's observing someone whose life is being destroyed by their personal wealth. It's the one whom Paul describes as being pierced through with many sorrows. You know, I watched a documentary a few nights ago. As I mentioned, I had a little cold and I wasn't sleeping very well. And so I got up in the middle of the night and thought I'll watch something on telly for an hour. That usually would put me to sleep. And the only thing I could find to watch was a documentary on the rock band ZZ Top. And so I watched this documentary. The amazing things you'll do in the middle of the night. I watched this documentary on ZZ Top. And, you know, it was interesting because they were interviewing the drummer, Frank Beard. And he recounted when he received his first big paycheck, which was $72,000 back in the 1970s. Now, if you were to equate that with modern day income, that would be around almost $500,000 in terms of spending power in relation to today. So if you can imagine someone receiving a check that says, your first big paycheck. $500,000. And he was asked, "Well, what did you do with it?" And here's what he said, quite literally, word for word. He said, "I spent it all on drugs." I couldn't believe it. I sat there and thought, what an idiot. I spent it all on drugs. And, you know, within a decade, his life was wrecked and he was in rehab. And we could stand here all day listing other famous actors and musicians and sports stars who did exactly the same thing. You see, material wealth doesn't make us instantly happy. And again, you know, we could listen to some of the wealthiest people who've ever lived and the things that they said in their day. Vanderbilt, W.H. Vanderbilt said, "The care of $200 million is enough to kill anyone." You think about that. Here you and I sit sometimes and we say, wouldn't it be great if you could win the lottery, if you could have £200 million? Here's a man who had that kind of money, and he said, "You have that kind of money, it's enough to kill anyone." He says there's no pleasure in it. Now, when you don't have that amount of money, you think that's got to be a ludicrous statement. Of course there's got to be some pleasure in it. You know, he eats at the best restaurants, he sleeps in the best hotels, he wears the best clothes, he travels first class. You know, everything has got to be perfect. He says, not so. John Jacob Astor, you've all heard of the Astor family. He said, "I am the most miserable man on earth." Rockefeller, he said, "I have made many millions, but they've brought me no happiness." You know, when I was looking all this up, a picture came up on my computer screen of Rockefeller. Actually, you know what? I felt sorry for him. When I saw his photograph, I felt sorry. I felt poor man. You know, and I thought to myself, how ironic, here I sit, you know, with a normal income, normal bills, and I'm looking at a man who's a multimillionaire, and I'm sitting saying of him, poor man. Poor man. Andrew Carnegie, the industrialist, said, "Millionaires seldom smile." And Henry Ford, who gave us the Ford Motor Company, said, "I was happy when I was doing a mechanic's job." And it's not just the famous that great wealth destroys. You know, if you go back and if you actually follow the lives of lottery winners, you'll find that their lives are peppered with death and depression and divorce and drink and drugs and debt. Believe it or not, many of those people who began doing the lottery were not in debt, but by the time the lottery was finished with them, they were in debt. Like Abraham Shakespeare, who won $17 million but was killed 3 years later by a woman who targeted him for his money. Or Jeffrey Dampier, who won $20 million, who was murdered by his sister-in-law and her husband because they thought that they would inherit his wealth. Or Bob Harrell, who won $31 million in 1987 but was stalked by strangers for handouts to such a degree that he killed himself. Or Jack Whittaker, who won $315 million, but his life soon descended into tragedy. The year after, thieves broke into his car and took $500,000, which were found in a suitcase he was keeping. Next year, they took $200,000. Then his granddaughter was found dead, wrapped in plastic with drugs in her system. Her boyfriend had died of an overdose just a few months earlier. 2 years later, his own daughter died of a drug overdose. By the time of her death, he said his bank accounts were empty. He blamed his relatives' deaths on the winning ticket, assuming that they had bought the drugs which killed them with his money. And he said this, quote, "My granddaughter is dead because of money. She was the shining star of my life. And she was what it was all about for me. You know, my wife said she wished that she had torn the ticket up. Well, I wish that we tore the ticket up too." What's the Bible say? Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 6, "In the house of the righteous is much treasure, but in the revenues of the wicked is trouble." In the revenue of the wicked, there is trouble. And so, friends, if you hear yourself saying, you know, if I could just win the lottery, you know, if I would just have this much money, what a difference. Stop. Correct yourself. And chastise your own greedy and covetous heart and say, no, actually, that would do me no good at all. And if God wanted me to have that money, guess what? I'd have that money. You've got to be careful of what you wish for. People who say, well, I wish that I could have this and I wish I could have that. What you have there might well end up, if you were to get it, might well end up destroying you. In fact, it will certainly shipwreck your faith. Then here's a sixth thought from verse 14. If you think about money problems, here's another money problem. The more you have, the more there is to lose. Verse 14. "But those riches perish by evil travail, and he begetteth a son, and there's nothing in his hand." Now, Proverbs chapter 13 and verse 22 says this, "A good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children, and the wealth of the sinner is laid up for the just." You know, every good man wants to leave his children something if he has children. He wants to leave a legacy, a financial legacy for his children that will help them along life's journey a little bit. But here Solomon pictures a man who has it all, but then perhaps because of poor investment or perhaps because of an economic collapse, maybe caused by war or caused by a pandemic or caused by who knows what, he ends up owing money, he loses it all, and he's broken. Now here's what I'm going to tell you. You should remember this. You never miss what you never had. You never miss what you never had. And, you know, money can go just as quickly as it comes. Again, Proverbs, the book of wisdom, says, "Labor not to be rich." Now, it's not saying don't work for a living. But it's saying don't make wealth your purpose. Labor not to be rich. That's not your goal. That's not your purpose. Cease, it says, from thine own wisdom. Wilt thou set thine eyes upon that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away as an eagle toward heaven. Somebody says, money talks. I agree, my money talks. It mostly says goodbye. And that's what the book of Proverbs is telling us, that money can go just as quickly as it comes. And then one last thought in verses 15 through 17. The more you have, the more you have to leave behind. Look in verse 15. "As he came forth of his mother's womb naked, shall he return to go as he came, and shall take nothing of his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a sore evil. This also makes me sick to the pit of my stomach, that in all points as he came, so shall he go. And what profit hath he that hath labored for the wind? All his days also he eateth in darkness, and he hath much sorrow and wrath with his sickness." You see what he says here? We've heard it said many times from this pulpit and elsewhere, you can't take it with you. You cannot take it with you. In the words of Job, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Or as Paul puts it, if we brought nothing into this world, it is certain we can carry nothing out. When you die, you leave it all. Everything. Every single thing. You can't take anything with you. You can't even take your clothes with you. It's all left behind. Now, if you're a sports fan, and particularly if you're interested in golf, you might have heard of the name of a golfer by the name of Simon Dyson. Simon Dyson played the European Tour. He secured 6 wins, including the KLM Open 3 times. At the end of one of his most successful and profitable years, he was asked by a reporter if there was anything he was afraid of, to which he replied, death. And then he said this, I'm in a position now where I can pretty much do as I want. Dying wouldn't be good right now. Well, that's the thing about death, isn't it? Death doesn't make appointments. Death doesn't take a concern for our plans. It doesn't matter how inconvenient it is. Hazel had an uncle one time who died on Christmas Eve. How inconvenient. I mean, didn't death realize that that was a holiday season? Didn't they recognize that it was going to upset the Christmas dinner plans? Didn't it realize that we were supposed to be happy and joyous, but instead we're sorrowing over a lost relative? No, death takes no account of those things. It takes no stock of our status. It takes no consideration of our plans. And I like how John Piper focuses the mind on this particular thought with this idea. He said, picture 269 people entering eternity through a plane crash in the Sea of Japan. Before the crash, there are a noted politician, a millionaire corporate executive, a playboy and his playmate, and a missionary kid on his way back from visiting grandparents. After the crash, they stand before God, utterly stripped of their MasterCards, checkbooks, credit lines, designer clothes, How to Succeed books, and Hilton Hotel reservations. Here are the politician, the executive, the playboy, and the missionary kid, all on level ground with nothing, absolutely nothing in their hands, possessing only what they brought in their hearts. And that's the reality, isn't it? Because when you and I die, we're leaving everything behind us. And the only thing we're going to face God with is what's in our hearts. You know, by the end of this chapter, Solomon returns to a truth that he's already touched on in this book. Indeed, he touches on it throughout the book. Namely, that to have real enjoyment in this life, you need to understand that blessing and enjoyment comes not from gold, but from God. That God gifts us to enjoy every day. That God gifts us to enjoy the things He has given unto us. Whether that's our homes, or our cars, or our clothes, or anything else that we might possess. If we enjoy them, as long as we're putting the Lord first, He will gift us to enjoy those things. But we have to release those things first. And we have to realize that material possessions are a poor substitute for an eternal God. Martha Snell Nicholson was a poet who learned that lesson, and she recorded the lesson in her poem entitled Treasures. Listen to her words in light of everything we've discussed this morning. One by one, God took them from me, all the things I valued most, till I was empty-handed. Every glittering toy was lost. And I walked earth's highways grieving in my rags of poverty till I heard His voice inviting, lift those empty hands to me. So I turned my hands toward heaven and He filled them with a store of His own transcendent riches till they could contain no more. And at last I comprehended with my stupid mind and dull that God could not pour His riches into hands already full. What's filling your hands this morning? What is it that prevents God from pouring His riches into your hands, into your life? Now, we're not talking here about material riches. I'm not talking here about health and wealth and prosperity gospel. In fact, the prosperity gospel people could probably learn from this particular chapter. But I'm saying here, are we missing out because we're longing after things which can never satisfy? Are we missing out because we're striving after things which don't provide an answer? Are we chasing the wind in our Christian lives? You know, are we longing after things other than God? And this chapter tells us to desire Him. to seek after Him and to find in Christ everything that we need. You know, maybe if you're watching online this morning and you're not a Christian, I want to say to you this morning that you ought to not fill your life with things. That you ought to consider your soul's destiny and to realize that someday every one of us are going to be stripped of all our earthly possessions and given account of ourselves to God. Now would be a good time to receive the Lord Jesus as your Savior and to trust in Him and to put God first in your life. May God bless these thoughts to your hearts this morning. Shall